Maddie is brought to you by 9.com.au. To enjoy some of our other great shows, such as NRL podcast Six Tackles with Gus, or our deep dive into the royal family, the Windsors, head to 9.com.au/podcasts or search for us wherever you listen.
In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't.
Before this week's episode, an update. Last week, DNA expert Dr. Mark Perlin offered to review forensic samples for free. That could prove or disprove if Madeline McCann's DNA was in a car hired by Kate and Jerry McCann 25 days after she vanished. Since then, I've had a number of phone calls and emails. This is one of those.
This is really important. I'll tell you what it is. The ABC to solving homicide is A, assume nothing, B, believe nothing, and C, check everything. If you do that as a detective, you will find the answer. In dealing with cold cases, the answer is always in the file. It is always in the file.
Paul James is an interesting character. He's from Melbourne, Australia. He's got a scientific background in DNA. He's served in the Victoria Police Force. And he's worked as a criminal barrister. Now he's gone full circle and back doing a PhD in medical science.
I see Mark as potentially an expert witness in this case. All right. In any investigation, whether it be on the prosecution side or the defence side, sourcing expert witnesses is commonplace. Now, Mark, with his expertise and his track record, is clearly an accredited expert in this field.
In episode 5, Mark Perlin told me how he could solve those DNA samples with powerful new testing methods he has pioneered. Mark also went further, offering to do those DNA tests for Scotland Yard at no cost. You'll recall some of that inconclusive DNA evidence was lifted from the boot of a rental car hired by Kate and Jerry McCann 25 days after Maddie vanished.
I see Mark. If I was in charge of this investigation and I really wanted to find out whose DNA was in the boot of that car, I would engage someone like him as an expert witness. If they've got the original DNA samples, give him those. If they've got, if they've only got the data, if they've got the exhibits, I'd be giving him everything he needs to do this analysis, because at the end of the day, it's that critical.
It was time to call Dr. Mark Perlin, Chief Scientist at Cybergenetics.
Hello.
Hello, Mark.
It was about 10 p.m. in Pittsburgh when Mark answered. He'd just got home after giving 2 days of evidence at a criminal trial. Mark said he was going to be up all night writing a DNA report for that trial in New York. I told him about my conversation with Paul, and I floated the idea that he should contact the London Metropolitan Police directly with the offer to analyse the DNA for no charge, once and for all, definitively answering this critical element of the case.
Well, I'm pleased that somebody thinks that would be a promising way forward. If you send me the appropriate contact information and addresses, I'd be happy to follow through on it. And honestly, I'd be surprised if the government opened up their data and ran the risk of admitting past mistakes.
I put it to Mark that if the London Metropolitan Police and Operation Grange turned down his offer or ignored it, it must raise serious questions about the investigation.
Well, I would hope that the Metropolitan Police might be aware of that view, and I welcome the opportunity to assist them in their investigation. I'd be happy to make the offer, speak with them, explain what's involved, and then conduct the work and show them the results.
I've sent Mark the FSS codes for a number of those DNA samples that he needs. I'll let you know how he goes. But for now, on with this week's episode.
Deixa meu nome completo, para dizer o nome completo.
Could you tell, say your full name, please?
Kate Marie Healy.
Kate Marie Healy?
Yeah.
Não tenho o apelido McCann.
You don't use the surname McCann?
On my official documents, I'm still in my maiden name, which is Healy.
Os documentos oficiais, ainda fiquei como Healy.
Sim, senhor. Pergunto-lhe o estado civil.
What is your marital status?
Married.
Casada.
E a profissão que tem?
And your profession?
By profession, I'm a medical doctor, but I haven't worked in the medical profession since my own subject.
And about this subject, you're obliged to speak the truth. And if you don't speak the truth, then you may be committing crime.
My name is Mark Salnokonoko, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeleine McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case. In July 2014, Kate and Jerry McCann travelled from England to Portugal to give testimony at the end of a long-running and bitter libel trial. The McCanns were seeking over £1 million in damages from retired Portuguese detective Gonzalo Amaral. The focus of the libel case was Amaral's explosive 2008 book, The Truth of the Lie. In it, he outlined a theory Madeleine McCann had died inside apartment 5A, an abduction was faked, and Madeleine's body had been removed from the property, remaining hidden to this day. There was also a Portuguese documentary based on the book, also called The Truth of the Lie, which had further angered the McCanns. Kate and Jerry have always rejected the book and the documentary as a compilation of fantastical, hurtful lies. Audio of Kate, Jerry and other key witnesses giving testimony in that acrimonious libel trial has never been heard outside the walls of that Lisbon courtroom before. But in this episode of Maddie, for the first time, you'll hear Kate and Jerry under oath describe the impact that Amaral's book had on their lives and the way that they said it damaged the search for Madeleine.
Did you think that people might have thought you were cowardly because you had hidden, because the book said you'd hidden the body?
I believe people probably did think that, yes.
Eu acredito que as pessoas provavelmente achavam isso.
But I think they probably thought worse.
Before we listen to more of that courtroom audio, it's important and relevant to look at the official Find Madeleine Fund. Just 2 weeks after Madeleine vanished, Kate and Jerry McCann set up the fund. Since 2007, it has amassed a fortune of well over £4 million. Much of that cash was donated by the public, but high-profile, uber-wealthy benefactors like author J.K. Rowling and billionaire Richard Branson also gave large sums of money to the McCanns. At its height, the public was reportedly giving the fund £260 an hour. That's more than £6,000 a day, which is roughly £43,000 a week, and ends up being more than £170,000 a month. We're talking big, big numbers here, and in the first year alone, almost £2 million had been given to the McCanns. It has always been unclear how much of that money, which was donated to support the search for Madeleine, the McCanns may have spent trying to sue people and media who accused them of potential involvement in Madeleine's disappearance. Despite public promises by the McCanns to run the fund with the highest standards of transparency, it's actually very hard to follow the money. The question is why? Why is that the case? To be clear, by choosing to operate the fund in this way, the directors of the fund, which include Kate and Jerry McCann, are not breaking the law in any way. But do the fund's reports dovetail with the charitable spirit of the countless people who donated money to help the McCanns search for Madeleine?
I'm joined now by Madeleine's great-uncle, Brian Kennedy, and he's going to tell us about the fighting fund. What's been the public's response to it, Brian?
Well, it's been very good so far, but a lot of people have said they're not quite sure how they can give money, so may I tell them?
Yes, very briefly.
Right, very briefly. You can go into any branch of the NatWest or the Royal Bank of Scotland and just say that you would like to make a contribution to the Madeleine Fund.
But tell me, Brian, about all the people that have been coming up to you to date, just literally stuffing money in your hand.
Yes, they have. It's very touching, very touching. I would just say this is not an appeal. The family haven't made an appeal. We've just set up a mechanism for people who said they wanted to do something and contribute, so that the money can be used for all sorts of reasons, but probably mainly for legal expenditure.
I think there's a couple of things worth noting in this interview, where BBC reporter Cathy Rochford is speaking with Brian Kennedy, Kate McCann's uncle. The interview took place on May 17, exactly 2 weeks after Maddie vanished. Money was coming in fast, and the fund was set up quickly. There was an immediate groundswell of sympathy for the McCanns, and that prompted a surge of donations to help the family try and find Maddie. I just want to play the final part of that interview again.
We've just set up a mechanism for people who said they wanted to do something and contribute, so that the money can be used for all sorts of reasons, but probably mainly for legal expenditure.
I found it curious that Brian Kennedy, at this extremely early stage, spoke about the fund being used for mainly legal expenditure. Just 2 weeks after Maddie goes missing, why the expectations and a focus on legal expenditure? Isn't the fund about searching for Maddie? It's worth noting, Brian Kennedy was already a director of the fund at this stage. But in order to learn anything about the fund, let's go back to the beginning. Numbers and accounting and finance aren't my thing, so I was going to need help. And I found that help all the way over in Dublin, Ireland, from a chartered accountant, a woman called Enid O'Dowd. I'd say aside from the directors of the fund and the fund's official auditors, there are few people who have paid as close attention to the fund's accounts than Enid. Enid has a pretty colourful background, so you can throw away your bean counter stereotypes. She's campaigned against alleged rorting of expenses by Irish politicians, and she does pro bono tax work for a charity in Dublin. In 1975, when she was living in Beirut, she got caught up in the chaos of a bomb explosion, right at the start of the 15-year Lebanon Civil War. I asked Enid how she became interested in the Madeleine McCann case.
Anyone who's a parent in particular would have reacted in a sympathetic way to the McCanns. It struck a personal note for me, having daughters, and it made me remember a time, a good long time ago, when I took my eye off my eldest daughter, Sarah, who was three then, because I was attending to her younger sister, who was one, and we were on a crowded beach in France. I think I was probably changing her sister's nappy, and then I looked up, and I couldn't see Sarah anywhere. The beach was crowded. I just initially panicked. Where the hell was she? And I couldn't really run around looking for her because I was in charge of a one-year-old. Now, I did find her, but I have never forgotten that moment of panic, and I did kind of feel for Kate McCann.
Enid has reviewed the published accounts of the fund every year. At the end of each financial year, auditors of the fund submit their report to Companies House in the UK. I asked Enid what, if anything, caught her attention in her 10 years of research.
Well, the big issue is transparency. I mean, I would feel, if I had donated money, and lots of very ordinary people, old age pensioners, children sent in their pocket money, there were lots of heart-rending stories about this. And I would say to him, you don't really know what your money was spent on. And I don't think the media covered it very well. I think I'm one of the few people who really looked at the accounts and the background to them. They did put some information, not accounts, on the website in 2007, 2008, and that stopped. They have never, ever put the audit accounts on the website. Now, personally, I don't trust any not-for-profit or charity that doesn't publish its accounts on its website. And even if they do, unless the accounts are detailed and you can see where the money is coming from and where it's going, I would advise anyone to view such an organization with skepticism.
Here's a fact about the fund. Despite receiving all that donated money, the fund is not a charity. The fund was set up as a not-for-profit limited company. Now that's quite important, and here's why. Whether intentional or not, being a limited company meant the fund would never be obligated to publish detailed financial accounts, accounts that outline exactly where and how the money was spent.
A limited company, an ordinary standard limited company, only has to publish limited information in the accounts it will file with Companies House. Charities have to give more detailed information in their published accounts, which is reasonable.
Enid explained to me that UK charities must hand over detailed accounts to the Charities Commission. And if a member of the public requests a copy of those detailed accounts, they must be given access. As Enid continued, she also pointed out another key difference between an LLC, a limited liability company, and a registered charity.
The directors of limited companies, they're normally called trustees, cannot normally receive salary, fees, or contracts from the charity, and nor can their spouses or other close family members.
That issue of trustees not having access to salaries, fees, or contracts was a sticking point for the McCanns. The media have always reported that the fund had to be set up as a not-for-profit limited company because it did not qualify as a charity. While not untrue, there is definitely more to that story. So let's take a look at that. Little more than 1 week after Maddie went missing, lawyers acting for the McCanns contacted the UK Charities Commission. They were seeking advice about whether the fund could be set up as a charity. I have seen internal documents from the Charities Commission, which were obtained through a Freedom of Information request lodged by Enid. These documents include several emails, a letter, and a telephone transcript. The documents revealed the McCanns' lawyers were in disagreement with the Charities Commission over a couple of issues, including one point in particular. The McCanns' lawyers wanted the fund's money to be available to support Maddie's family. The Charities Commission, though, said this was against the rules of a charitable organisation and therefore was unacceptable. Here's Enid explaining the background to this impasse.
One of the objectives of the fund, now the main one was to secure the safe return of Madeleine McCann, but one of them was to provide support, including financial assistance, to Madeleine's family. And people said, well, why would they need financial support? The McCanns are both doctors, and doctors are well-paid professionals.
A possible answer could be the McCanns felt they couldn't focus on work while Maddie was still missing. It was unclear at this stage just how long Kate and Jerry might need to be in Portugal, away from their jobs and with no steady income. In a flurry of back and forth communication, the Charities Commission put forward several options to the McCanns' lawyers in an attempt to find a solution. But an agreement could not be reached. Instead, the McCanns' lawyers went ahead and they set up a not-for-profit company. It was called Madeleine's Fund, leaving no stone unturned. The date was 15 May, 12 days after Maddie went missing. In her book, Madeleine, Kate McCann wrote about the setting up of the fund. She stated, "From the outset, everyone agreed, despite the costs involved, it must be run to the highest standards of transparency." Enid O'Dowd has looked at each and every one of the fund's 11 financial statements, which have been submitted annually to UK Companies House. She argues the information released has fallen short of Kate McCann's guarantee.
The public have been promised transparency. I mean, in writing, in the book, it's absolutely clear. and they got the reverse of that for absolutely no reason. Being transparent doesn't normally cost anything. All they had to do was to tell the auditors to ensure the accounts are detailed, and what reason is there not to be transparent?
Enid estimates around £4 million has been paid into the fund. That's a combination of donations from the public, money from libel damages against UK newspapers, and royalties from Kate McCann's book. Enid can't actually get definitive about this figure, because the accounts grow increasingly less transparent. From 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2018. There's currently £825,000 in the fund. It's not possible to know where most of the £3 million has been spent. The fund submitted its very first annual financial report in 2008. That report was very interesting, and in retrospect, it would be the most detailed account of financial activity that the fund would ever file.
The first two accounts, to be fair to them, they did give an expenses breakdown, but that actually caused them problems because it appeared from the figures that only 13% of the income had been spent on searching, i.e. paying detectives to supplement the search that was going on through the official police channels. And the accounts were, I think I mentioned this earlier in our chat, were unclear because they showed 180,321 spent on legal fees, but there was no note to explain, you know, why they had such high legal fees. Who were these professionals they were spending money on? I mean, the public expected that most of the money would be on detectives, and obviously the expenses the detectives would have, obviously a lot of travel costs going around, following up leads and so on. So it concerned people that 13% appeared to be the amount of money spent on searching, and there was a lot of criticism.
Enid ran through the report with me, talking me through the numbers. Between May 2007 and March 2008, a total of £1,846,000 was donated to the Find Maddie Fund. The money spent on lawyers, £180,000, accountants, £7,000, auditors, £13,000, and PR media monitoring, £26,000, totaled almost £270,000. The fund itself cost £69,000 in fees to set up. Enid mentioned how just 13% of the total income had been spent on searching. The report lists £250,000 under a category called search fees. This money was spent on a private detective firm called Metodo 3 from Barcelona, Spain. Remember that name, Metodo 3, because I'm going to come back to this firm shortly. I do think it's a bit unfair to say only 13% of the fund's total in 2008 was spent on searching for Maddie. The report lists an awareness campaign, which totaled just over £81,000. To me, an awareness campaign would form part of an overall search strategy. The cost of managing that campaign was listed at almost £125,000. So, to recap, in the first year, the £270,000 that was spent on professional fees was more than the £250,000 on search fees. In October 2007, 5 months after Maddie vanished, the McCanns hired a private detective firm from Spain called Metodo 3 on a significant retainer of £50,000 per month. The PI firm set up a tip-off phone line and chased potential sightings in Europe and Morocco. In March 2008, Metodo 3's contract was not renewed, and the months before, the British press had grown increasingly sceptical of Metodo 3's credentials. A series of damaging articles exploring Metodo 3 and its work began to appear. There seemed to be doubt over how well qualified Metodo 3 was to carry out the investigation. And the work that was being carried out, well, it attracted some criticism and suspicion. an artist's sketch of a supposed suspect, which was produced and made public by Matodo 3, had no credibility according to Portuguese police. And just before Christmas in 2007, the director of Matodo 3, Francisco Marco, gave an incredible interview to a Spanish newspaper and US broadcaster, CBS.
I know the kidnapper, and we know where he is. We know who he is, and we know how he has done it.
Francisco Marco claimed Maddie was not only alive, but that she would be home by Christmas. At the time, Christmas was just 12 days away. Joseph Mora is a private investigator CBS had hired to work on its special news investigation. We'll hear more from him in a later episode, but for now, he was asked if he believed the claims of Francisco Marco.
No, I don't believe him. I think it's a pretty ridiculous statement to be making.
I tried to call Francisco Marco several times. He picked up once, but he hung up on me as soon as I began to ask him about the Madeleine McCann case. I did manage to speak with a former director of Matodo 3, which ended up going into liquidation and closing down in 2011. Alessandra Villena was the operations and security director for Matodo 3. She agreed to talk with me on the phone from her home in Barcelona. As you listen to Alessandra, keep in mind a couple of things. One, some context of our conversation could have been lost in translation. And two, Alessandra quit Matodo 3 after an obvious falling out with Francisco Marco. She told me she'd not been paid for several months before she quit. Alessandra's claims do tally with news reports in Spain that Matodo 3 was embroiled in salary disputes with various employees. What struck me while talking to Alessandra for about an hour was how little work it appeared Matodo 3 had actually done in the search for Maddie. Here I asked Alessandra how they carried out their investigation and what kind of work was done.
Well, we don't have any plan, any concrete plan, because we have a call center and our email account. And we received a lot of clues. And then part of my work, it was to take that information and decided if it's a good idea to investigate the clues or not.
Alessandra told me that she had been in charge of Maddie leads in Portugal, Spain and France. I asked her what was the strongest clue she ever followed up. Was there a time she believed she could have been close to finding Maddie?
Well, there was a lot of times. But I remember one, I was thinking that finally it was Madeleine because they sent us a picture taken in a restaurant with a woman, with a girl, very similar to Madeleine. I go to France, it was in France, I go to the restaurant, I saw the picture, and finally we were concluded that it's not Madeleine.
Hearing that, I remember thinking, is that it? I also asked Alessandra about the infamous Francisco Marco interview, where he boasted Maddie would be home by Christmas. I asked why he'd said that. What information was it based on?
I don't know why he said it. I remember perfect the moment who said there was an interview and he said at the in Christmas and Madeleine go home. And I read that interview in the press and I call Francisco Marco and I say, do you know anything that I don't know? Do you have any clue that I don't have? Why do you say that? And he say me, because I think Joe.
At the end of our call, I asked Alessandra what happened to Madeleine. She told me she thought Maddie had been the victim of an organized abduction. She said Kate and Jerry were not involved in her disappearance. I asked if she thought Madeleine was alive or dead.
I will prefer that he's alive. I will prefer. Because if he's not died, if she's alive, I don't want to imagine what kind of life she had.
Mm-hmm.
In 2014, the McCann's fight against Portuguese detective Gonzalo Amaral was well and truly underway. The McCanns had travelled to Lisbon to give evidence at the libel trial. On the stand, Jerry McCann gave evidence for about 25 minutes. This was not a criminal trial, so he was never asked any questions about Madeline's disappearance. He was there to talk about Gonzalo Amaral's book and the documentary, which both pointed the finger of blame towards Kate and Jerry. This audio, which I have obtained, has never been heard outside the courtroom before. My producer Dan has had to work his magic on this audio. Portuguese lawyers are working with translators, so everything is continually being translated between Portuguese and English. Things are a little stop-start and jilted. Anyway, you'll see what I mean.
When
you read the book, how did you feel?
The media coverage of the book, even before I had read it in person, caused us immense distress.
And the book itself?
The book itself is shocking. It's an affront to me, to my wife, to my family, and all the people who believe in us. The hardest emotion is anguish, despair, and of course anger, that someone who was so close to the investigation claims to prove, without any evidence, that our missing daughter, to whom we've done everything within our power to find, states that she is unequivocally dead. The documentary is even worse than the book. It starts off stating right at the beginning that Madeline is dead, that there was no abduction, and essentially claims that myself and my wife and our friends are liars and would be so cold and ruthless as to hide our daughter's body rather than try and then help her should something have happened.
One of the main thrusts of the McCann's legal argument was they believed the book and documentary had a hugely negative impact on the search for Maddie. In short, if people thought Maddie was dead, there's no missing girl. Why be vigilant? Here, seeking to emphasize that point, the McCann's lawyer asked Jerry about a story that appeared in a Portuguese daily tabloid.
I have seen many different interviews given. There were articles almost on a daily basis, so you may have to give me specific text because there were so many.
The lawyer then reads the court part of that article, directly quoting Gonzalo Amaral.
The girl died in the apartment. It's all in the book, which is faithful to the investigation until September. It reflects the understanding of the Portuguese, English and English police. For all of us, it had all been proved. The hiding of the corpse, the simulation of the abduction, and abandoning the body.
We have had very many sleepless nights over the publication of this book. It causes tremendous distress and anxiety.
In the libel case, the McCanns were also out to prove how much anguish Amaral's book and the documentary had caused their family.
Do you think that most people think that the theories in the book are true?
So when the file was closed, it was made explicitly clear that there was no evidence that Madeline is dead and that there was no evidence to support the assertion that Kate and I were responsible in any way for hiding Madeline's body.
I just want to replay part of Jerry's answer. Jerry is talking about a file. What he's referring to is a report written by the Portuguese Attorney General in July 2008 when the case was shelved. That report summarised all the evidence produced by the investigation. So here's Jerry.
When the file was closed, it was made explicitly clear that there was no evidence that Madeline is dead.
Jerry's position that the report had explicitly stated there was no evidence that Madeline was dead, well, that was arguably not the only way to interpret that report. In the report, a key paragraph outlined why the case had been shelved. It spoke of the struggle to find irrefutable evidence to conclusively prove what had happened to Madeline. one way or another. That paragraph outlining the struggle included doubt over how Maddie had been removed from the apartment, whether she had been killed intentionally or died by accident, whether she was the victim of a targeted or opportunistic abduction. The report said police didn't have conclusive evidence to prove if Maddie was dead or alive, but there was a line that added it was more probable that Madeline was dead. The report added that Maddie's case was incredibly complex, that police had operated under intense, almost unparalleled media pressure. The report noted this wasn't a Sherlock Holmes mystery, which could be neatly tied up and solved. It said police could not have a safe or rigorous case to know what crimes had been committed against Maddie, other than an apparent case of neglect. It found there were no sufficiently consistent indications to substantiate an abduction. Conversely, again, underlining the struggle, the report stated there were no indications of a crime carried out by Gerald Patrick McCann and Kate Marie Healy. Trish Cameron, Jerry's older sister, she also testified in the libel case. After Maddie vanished, Trish, who was also Madeline's godmother, she spent many weeks in Praia da Luz supporting Kate and Jerry. Here, she tells the court about the impact of the book in Portugal.
When Jerry came back to Portugal in April 2009, he was jeered at in the street. He'd been advised to bring some sort of security with him because feeling was so bad against them. My brother and sister-in-law, they live in purgatory because they have no end, and they are looking for the truth, and they would like an end, but there is no end.
At the end of her testimony, Gonzalo Amaral's lawyer, Santos Oliveira, put two questions to Trish Cameron. Remember, an apparent cornerstone of the McCann legal case had been that claims in the book and documentary that Madeline was dead were unfounded.
Did you know that the British police gave indications to the Portuguese police that Madeline was dead?
No.
Did you know that when the court order was made to shelve the case, that the Attorney General said it was most probable that Madeline was dead?
Yes, I did know that.
During the libel trial, a trauma specialist called Alan Pike appeared on the stand. Alan Pike is a partner for a British firm called the Centre for Crisis Psychology. The company's website details its work with victims of the 1988 Lockerbie Pan Am plane bombing, the 2004 Boxing Day tsunami, and the London 77 tube bombings. Working on behalf of Mark Warner Limited, the holiday operator who owned the Ocean Club Resort, Alan Pike flew into Praia da Luz just 2 days after Maddie vanished. He has remained close friends with the McCanns to this day. Giving testimony, Alan explained how Kate McCann was suffering under unimaginable pressure. There was another part of Alan's testimony I found interesting. It directly contradicted with the evidence of Jerry's sister, Trish Cameron. Alan Pike and Trish Cameron were both asked about the impact on Kate and Jerry of being named arguidos, formal suspects. Here's Alan Pike's recollection.
Kate and Jerry were confused as to why they weren't arguidos much sooner, because it's quite normal in an investigation to a child disappearing for the people who are closest to them to be investigated. Really, I don't think that being made arguido was particularly traumatic for them.
And now, Trish Cameron.
When they were made arguido, they were very unhappy. Their arguido status was bad, and they were very upset and angry about that.
When Kate McCann gave evidence, she was never asked about becoming an arguido, but her lawyer did ask how she felt after reading Gonzalo Amaral's book.
It's very painful to read. I felt sad for Madeline. He insists that Madeline was dead without any evidence. He also essentially accuses myself and my husband of being implicit somehow in her disappearance, of faking an abduction.
Did you think that people might have thought you were cowardly because you had hidden, because the book said you'd hidden the body?
I believe people probably did think that, yes. I think they probably thought worse. There can be no worse pain than having your child abducted. The other things that have happened have compounded that pain and distress. There's a limit to how much one person can handle.
In April 2015, at the end of a trial which began almost 18 months earlier, the judge ruled in favour of the McCanns. Gonzalo Amaral was ordered to pay the McCanns 500,000 euros. But the fight didn't stop there. In 2016, Amaral appealed that decision and won, overturning the ruling. The McCanns in turn challenged that ruling and took their appeal to Portugal's highest court, the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court threw out the McCann appeal. In their ruling, the judges said the claims Gonzalo Amaral made in his book were protected by freedom of expression laws. It was a stinging loss for the McCanns, and the defeat was made even worse by what the judges had said in their ruling. They said just because the police had shelved the case in 2008, that did not mean the McCanns had been cleared of a crime. They said that insufficiency of evidence did not equate to the McCanns' innocence. On the next episode of Maddie.
Ask yourself, do you go through your phone and delete all of your logs? And then, yeah, there may be some things you delete just to clear things out, or like I'll delete my text messages usually. But the phone calls themselves, the ones I received or made, are usually just stored there. And so for somebody to delete phone calls, who they were calling, who called them, would raise a red flag and something you want to take a look at.
Strange activity on Kate and Jerry's mobile phones, and claims the call logs have been manipulated. Plus, what happens late on May 1, when the tapas bar is hosting a quiz night? A woman living above the McCanns hears a little girl in distress. The girl cries for over an hour, calling out for her daddy. The Maddie podcast is reported, written and narrated by me, Mark Salnokonoko. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.